Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Carrie Gephardt, counsel for appellant Icicle Seafoods. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
This appeal raises an issue of first impression regarding the limits on a plaintiff's ability to seek a Rule 41 voluntary dismissal where summary judgment proceedings have advanced past the point of the plaintiff submitting a substantive and unqualified briefing in opposition as well as supporting affidavits. The facts have been set forth in great detail in our briefing, but just by a very brief thumbnail here, the parties engaged in contentious litigation regarding respondents' maritime personal injuries claims, and trial was ultimately set for May 31st, 2016. In April 2016, the appellant timely filed a motion for summary judgment on all of respondents' claims. On May 2nd, 2015, the respondent filed a comprehensive and substantive opposition to the motion with supporting affidavits and other evidence. And then 2 days later, on May 4th, 2016, the respondent filed a motion for voluntary dismissal without prejudice under Civil Rule 41.
If they had filed the motion for the non-suit at the same time they filed their responsive pleadings on the merits, would we be...
If they had filed it concurrently with their opposition, maybe.
And what would your theory be then?
Our theory would be, as stated in our briefing, Your Honor, the filing of the opposition is in and of itself a sign of participation in the summary judgment proceedings. It's a submission on behalf of the plaintiff.
Is there a case that uses that test, sign of participation?
That's my take on the Beritich test in terms of submission. Beritich defined submission in the context available to them then in 1966, which preceded the adoption of Civil Rule 41 in 1967. And at that time, the court, the Beritich court, identified submission as kind of the threshold of inquiry. And I think the quote exactly would be, whether a non-moving party in a summary judgment procedure should be entitled as a matter of right to a voluntary non-suit after the motion for summary judgment had been submitted to the court. Now, in Beritich, the facts were very different.
Let me just take you to a different fact pattern.
Sure.
Because we use submission in this context as well. Plaintiff shows up at trial. Plaintiff calls all of its witnesses. After the defense is cross-examined, the last plaintiff's witness, the trial judge, looks over at plaintiff's counsel, expecting plaintiff's counsel to say, I rest, and instead plaintiff's counsel says, I move for a voluntary non-suit pursuant to CR 41. How is that different than this case?
This case, Your Honor, we would argue is different in a couple of respects. The first is trying to marry, if you will, or reconcile the summary judgment procedure with that available to a plaintiff under Rule 41. The language that I believe your factual scenario was referring to is the part of Rule 41 that says, upon motion of the plaintiff at any time before plaintiff rests at the conclusion of plaintiff's opening case. And as you've laid out, Your Honor, the plaintiff could rest, the plaintiff could invoke Rule 41, the trial could go forward to, you know, defense
position. I'm thinking
defense
of the
position.
Word submission, though. You focused on the summary judgment is submitted to
right.
the court, even though the court has oral argument scheduled. Your argument seems to assume that oral argument means nothing and is not part of the process before the matter is submitted to the court.
I guess we would define submission, Your Honor, in terms of the affirmative action by the plaintiff in submitting to the summary judgment process. For example, the language of the rule is before the plaintiff rests at the conclusion of the plaintiff's opening case. The language in Beritich defines the test in terms of submission. Our position is that the functional equivalent of the plaintiff resting their position is the filing of an opposition in the context of a summary judgment procedure, because the opposition contains the entirety of the evidence,
so
the entirety of the plaintiff's position.
So the oral argument is a useless task and adds nothing to what the court thinks about when it considers the merits of the issue before it.
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. That's not
then
our position.
Then how can you have a submission before oral argument?
Because just as you can have the plaintiff's completion of their case in chief before their closing arguments, you can have a submission before the oral argument occurs. The oral argument is a function in terms of summary judgment. It's not an evidentiary function. The submission in terms of the opposition is the entirety of the evidence and legal positions that the court, that the plaintiff is asking the court to consider in resolving the request for affirmative summary judgment relief.
Doesn't it seem that just as a practical matter, if something is submitted to the court for decision, the court once will have everything that the parties have to offer before a decision is going to be made? And in this case, in many cases, this case here today, oral argument is part of that submission, part of what the court's going to consider before it makes a decision. And it just seems that until all of that is done, the case has not been submitted.
Well, Your Honor, thank you for that. We our position is that the submission in the context of determining where the right to a Rule 41 voluntary dismissal is lost is analyzed in terms of, you know, well, Berichich defines submission. We believe that submission was the word that the court used because Rule 41 wasn't in play then. They were looking at the voluntary non-suit statute, which actually is,
your time's running low. What policy would we be furthering by adopting your position rather than the position that it's not submitted till after oral argument?
Well, I believe that the policies that would be adopted are those as articulated in, for example, CR Civil Rule 1 in terms of just, speedy, and efficient trials and conclusions of matters.
Which part of just and efficient? Just efficient.
I guess it depends on which side of the table you're sitting on, Your Honor.
Justice isn't furthered by oral argument.
No, the oral argument is a component of the summary judgment procedure.
I mean, you're very dismissive of oral argument in this because you want, like the word submission, but I'm having a hard time figuring out a good reason why we would accept your use of the word submission. What are we furthering? How are we benefiting what we're supposed to be doing?
In terms of the policy behind Civil Rule 41?
Just the whole purpose of having courts as a forum for deciding disputes between parties.
And there was no intention on our part to say that the oral argument portion was not a portion of the procedure, just as, you know, closing arguments are a portion of a trial. There's no other point before oral argument other than the plaintiff's opposition, where the plaintiff puts forth an affirmative position on the request for summary judgment. The court may discuss that with the parties at oral argument. The court may seek clarification at oral argument, just as you're doing here. And that is a feature of oral argument. But in terms of equating the summary judgment procedure.
Think that's an important feature of a motion practice?
It can be. It's not always, but it can be in general terms. And the functional equivalent of the plaintiff resting at the conclusion of their case in our briefing and in our position is their submission of their opposition, an opposition that had no qualifications.
You know, your position's abundantly clear.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm struggling with is a good reason to adopt.
I understand. Thank you, Your Honor.
You might want to think about that.
I will.
Good morning. May it please the court, Scott Smith for Carlos Gutierrez. I think Green Law versus Wren basically is directly on point here. What happened there is very, very much what happened here. They didn't file their CR 41 motion until after the time to file a response had expired.
They didn't file a response, did they?
They did not file a response, but by not filing a response, they weren't entitled to then file anything more, like we weren't entitled to file anything.
You picture judges thinking, well, if I've gone to the trouble of reading all of this summary judgment material, now I get the CR 41 motion. It's too late.
I apologize. I didn't understand the question.
Well, imagine yourself as the trial judge, and you've gotten the motion for summary judgment. You've gotten the responsive materials. You got the reply materials. You took them all home, and you read them. And the day before the summary judgment hearing, someone files a CR 41 motion to dismiss the plaintiff's case. You might think, gosh, that should have happened earlier. This is too late. This doesn't further anything that we're supposed to have in the way of either judicial efficiency or fairness, because there was plenty of time to do this.
Well, there was plenty of time to do it all throughout a trial process as well. It doesn't need to be done right up until right before the plaintiff rests his case. I think that the rule puts down a pretty definitive line as to when a CR 41 dismissal can be taken, and that's the plaintiff resting his case, And in the context of summary judgment, Green Law says that that is at the hearing. That's when submission occurs, is at the hearing. We were entitled to a hearing to have oral argument on it. And summary judgment can't be entered unless there's no genuine issue as to a material fact and the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So even if our oral argument...
That being the test, what could happen at oral argument that would change whether the party is entitled to summary judgment or not?
Our ability to argue the law and the interpretation of it to the court and to make anything clear in our position to the court, that's the point of oral argument, is for us to be able to explain that position and answer any questions that the judge may have.
What if at the time this case was pending, you're on the way to the courthouse to file your CR 41 motion, and the court has had its bailiff email the party saying the court's decided it doesn't want to hear oral argument, striking the case from the oral argument calendar. Is your motion timely if you get to the courthouse after you get that email?
I believe it is timely because it occurred before the hearing. And that is what Green Law has held. That is the standard from Green Law itself.
So it isn't the substance of what takes place at a hearing that makes a difference. That's just an artificial deadline?
I don't believe so. I think that there is substance to what occurs at the hearing. But I also think that there's a span of time in between the reply and the hearing where, say, the non-movement may be able to put in a CR 56F motion if something else comes up that they want a continuance on the hearing or something to that effect. I think that up until the date of the hearing, there is a right to a voluntary dismissal based on what Green Law says. Paulson says the same thing, and Beretich based its decision largely, and it was based on the facts of the case, but in looking at that the court will enter summary judgment forthwith at the hearing if there's no genuine issue of material fact, and it looked to the statute for entering a voluntary dismissal at a bench trial, which was up until the judge renders a decision, and no decision had been rendered here and the hearing had not occurred.
You withdrew your claim for maintenance and cure?
We did withdraw our claim for maintenance and cure.
What claims for economic damages were encompassed in the withdrawal of that claim?
Everything related to the claim for maintenance and cure. So it was failure to pay maintenance and cure. It was failure to anything related to administration of benefits as to the maintenance and cure. So any of the underlying administration of those, the timeliness of those, anything related to the maintenance and cure, the punitive damages claim, as related to the failure to pay maintenance and cure. There is certainly a difference between the failure to pay and the failure to provide maintenance and cure, which I made clear in the brief. We have not gotten rid of the failure to provide maintenance and, or provide cure, I should say.
What about claims for lost wages or the ability to impairment of the future ability to earn wages?
Well, we have withdrawn those, and those were not part of the maintenance and cure claim, so to speak.
Okay.
But we did withdraw those, and in the lawsuit we have now filed, based on the statute of limitations, we had to file it while this was coming up on appeal. We've not realleged those claims.
Should the trial court have dismissed those claims with prejudice?
It should not have dismissed those claims with prejudice, and there's a couple reasons for that. I'm going to get the name of this wrong. Esquade versus King County Public Hospital District makes clear that the discretion to dismiss with prejudice should be made only when to dismiss without prejudice would be pointless. Here it was not pointless. We withdrew those claims prior to summary judgment. The defendants did not make those claims part of the summary judgment process, so they weren't going to be dismissed on summary judgment. They could have done that. They could have said, hey, they've withdrawn the claim, let's get summary judgment on this too. They didn't do that. So those weren't going to be thrown out on summary judgment. The statute of limitations had not run on those claims yet. So it wasn't going to be pointless to dismiss those without prejudice. And I would make the point as well that the King County Public Hospital District case the lead case in that, it was a combined appeal. The lead case in that had the procedural posture of this case here. The plaintiffs there had filed a response. I don't know how comprehensive it was, but they had filed a response and then filed a CR-41A voluntary dismissal motion after that. And the point of the case was whether it should be dismissed with prejudice or not, and that's where the discretion comes in, and that's why Askew talks about the discretion standard. There's no discretion in whether to voluntarily dismiss if the motion is timely. The discretion comes into whether it should be with or without prejudice. So I don't believe that that was improperly dismissed without prejudice. I do believe that it's somewhat moot at this point since we haven't refiled them and the statute of limitations will have run by now.
Our record wouldn't disclose that, though, would it?
No, it wouldn't. So, but in any event, that I believe the statute has run on those now.
Now that some of your claims have been refiled, you would concede that 41D allows the trial court currently to impose costs or terms?
It gives the current trial court that ability to do that, pending any discussion as to what could be reusable in the case, what may not be wasted fees or costs from the original case. But yeah, CR-41D definitely gives the court the ability to hear that and impose fees. And I don't have anything else for your honors, unless you have any other questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
2 minutes.
Thanks, your honors. In response to the question that you were trying to pose to me during the original argument, and which I needed a better answer for, I believe that equating the plaintiff's opposition brief when they file it without qualification would further interest that the court would be interested in, this court should be interested in. Number one would be efficiency, as you already recognized. Number two would be certainty. I mean, as opposing counsel has already identified, there's already another lawsuit filed. It's stayed pending what's going on here. There's already another lawsuit filed. Also expense. This court referenced the CR 41D option. You know, my opposing counsel has identified some ways in which they attempt to erode our entitlement to that, but the costs in this matter were significant, very significant. And in terms of expense to my client and even expense to all parties, we have to have a very clear-cut line as to at what point should we be waiting for an axe to fall here if we file a motion for summary judgment. Is it when the oral argument starts? Or is it, rather, when the plaintiff decides to participate in summary judgment, files an opposition, and has no qualification, no request for 56F, no identification of any reason why the matter can't go forward, and no further action on behalf of the plaintiff other than showing up for the oral argument portion as part of the summary judgment procedure? And I believe that it would further all of those criteria. I do want to disagree with my opponent in regard to the economic loss claims. I haven't seen any case law or argument that makes a distinction to me as to why a claim that was abandoned a year before the summary judgment procedure makes a difference in how it's treated on a with or without prejudice basis as to a claim that was abandoned at the opposition itself. So to me, they're identical. They just abandoned one earlier. I do believe there are components of that claim in the lawsuit that's currently pending. And, again, we'd ask the court with respect to reverse the trial court's order and reinstitute the cause of action to its point of time of May 12, 2016. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.